This is WORT Madison.
Hello, I'm Emily Thomas with the BBC News. President Macron of France has warned Russia against trying to exploit Friday's deadly militant attack on a Moscow concert venue in order to blame Ukraine. IS says it carried out the attack, in which at least 137 people were killed. Here's Danny Eberhard.
The massacre's political repercussions continue to reverberate at home and abroad. Following attempts by Russian officials to implicate Ukraine, President Emmanuel Macron said French intelligence had evidence that Islamic State had carried out the attack. He said it would be cynical and counterproductive to try to turn the blame on Kyiv, but offered Moscow cooperation. The Kremlin has signalled it needed no help and refused to comment on the IS claim, saying the investigation was still ongoing. The suspected gunmen, all Tajik, were presented in court in Moscow late on Sunday.
The Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, has come under renewed Russian attack. The Air Force said it shot down two ballistic missiles, but officials said falling debris landed on several districts, damaging a sports hall and injuring at least five people. The European Commission has launched investigations into three of the world's biggest tech companies over uncompetitive practices. Alphabet, Meta, and Apple are all being looked into for potential breaches of the Digital Markets Act. Zoe Kleinman reports.
The first five cases of potential breaches of the EU's Digital Markets Act are deliberately very consumer-focused. They'll be highly relatable to most people who use the products and services of these tech giants, which is collectively billions worldwide. Why can't you uninstall Apple's photo app? Is it fair that you can only either pay Meta for ad-free access or let it use your data to target ads at you on Facebook and Instagram? Are the top results on Google search more frequently those of its own services? And there's more to come. The EU is also looking into whether Amazon preferences its own products on its hugely popular marketplace.
London is expected to link Beijing to cyber attacks on Britain's Electoral Commission that compromised personal data of millions of voters. The attacks took place 3 years ago, but were only revealed last year. Laura Bicker reports.
The spokesperson for Beijing's foreign ministry, Lin Jian, avoided mentioning the United Kingdom by name, but he said there should be sufficient objective evidence of a cyber attack before countries made what he described as baseless accusations. He said that investigating cyber incidents was highly complex and sensitive, and it was crucial countries did not politicise these issues. He also claimed China was one of the world's main victims of cyber attacks. His words echo previous responses from Beijing, which all seem to be challenging the UK to show clear evidence that China was behind the hack.
BBC News.
Hi, my name is Vicky Kenyon. I'm your host for this week's Access Hour on WORT Madison, and I am a connector. I have always loved connecting people with one another and connecting people to resources. As I dove into my second career as a realtor, I found that much of the queer and trans community on a national level is not connecting to home ownership in ways that the rest of our country does. I want to change that. My aim is to make a significant positive impact on queer and trans home ownership here in Dane County. So, after a lot of networking and a lot of planning, I gathered a team of four other professionals and launched a free educational series that provides resources and answers to questions around home ownership in an inclusive, welcoming, and safe space. And now, we bring our knowledge to you here. On this week's Access Hour, my team and I will be here talking Home Ownership 101 and answering your questions live.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Budget Bicycle Center's used bicycle showroom located at 930 Regent Street. Open for curbside service estimates and sales, 251-1663. More information on Budget Bicycles services for new and used bicycles is available on the web at budgetbicyclectr.com.
Good morning, it's 8:05 and you're tuned to the Monday 8 o'clock buzz on WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org. This is Brian Standing. Governor Evers signed a slate of election reform bills, and we have new, presumably fairer, legislative maps in effect for the 2024 elections. Is it enough, or is there more to do to make Wisconsin's elections fair and transparent? Jay Heck from Common Cause shares his opinion. And the Midwest Mujeres Collective seeks to help women of all cultures achieve their entrepreneurial dreams through storytelling. Midwest Mujeres founder Araceli Esparza and graffiti nails proprietor Catalina Sanchez join us with more. And the city of Madison has declared the home of second wave feminist activist Catherine K. Clarenbach a Madison landmark. Historian and preservation activist Gary Tipler reflects on Clarenbach's life and influence. We'll have all that, plus some announcements, the Outdoor Adventure Report, and some tasty tunes served up by our engineer, Nate Carlin. All that's coming up right after this. It's 8:09. You're tuned to the Monday 8 o'clock buzz. This is Brian Standing. On March 21st, Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers signed four bipartisan bills to reform Wisconsin elections. Wisconsin Act 123 requires political advertisements to disclose the use of artificial intelligence to generate content. Act 124 limits a municipality's ability to close polling places within 30 days of an election. And Act 125 raises the cap on the maximum number of nomination signatures candidates can collect. Act 126 requires candidates to file campaign finance reports with the State Ethics Commission and makes it a felony to threaten an election official. All four laws take effect before the 2024 November elections, as do new state legislative districts hastily enacted under the threat of unilateral action by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So, are these signs that Wisconsin is finally returning to its pro-democracy roots, or is there more work to be done? Jay Heck is the executive director of Wisconsin Common Cause, and he joins us now by phone. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Good morning, Brian. Great to be with you on this gray, dark Monday morning.
So, speaking of gray, dark mornings, is this the dawning of a new era in Wisconsin elections? We saw this spate of bipartisanship coming out of the legislature and a number of these bills, which is almost unheard of out of the state legislature. And you know, many of these things seem to observers to be somewhat reasonable actions to take to help protect elections. Is this a new dawn?
Well, it's the beginning of a glimpse of some sunlight, maybe is the better way to put it. After 13 years of partisanship, polarization, and attempts to make voting more difficult in Wisconsin, this session was a little different in the sense that, at least in the assembly, the new chair of the committee, a Republican chair by the name of Scott Krug from Wisconsin Rapids, was determined not to bring up partisan Republican bills that he knew would be vetoed by the governor. And of course, that's exactly what happened during 21 and 22. There were 40 voter suppression types of legislation that Republicans passed with only Republican votes. They were vetoed by the governor. And so this time they wanted to explore areas of some bipartisan cooperation. And the four bills the governor signed on Friday were relatively minor. They weren't, you know, they're not going to dramatically change the scope of elections, big slight improvements in some areas, but the fact is they're bipartisan and they're not, they're not attempting to disenfranchise one political party like we've seen in the past. So yeah, I guess a bit of a difference than what we've seen certainly 4 years ago and even 3 years ago.
And what do you think the inspiration for this sudden display of collegiality across the aisle might be?
Well, I think part of it is that there was a realization on the part of some of the Republicans that, you know, you can continue to beat your head against a wall and you can either get bloodier or you can try to figure a way to at least scale the wall to some degree. And I think in that score, that, you know, these bills that were signed requiring disclosure for artificial intelligence used in political ads, a bit more uniformity in terms of and notice in terms of closing polling places in times of a pandemic. Again, these are things that are relatively minor. But I think there was a realization on the part of Republicans, we've got to try to show voters that we can actually get some stuff passed. You know, I think what was significant on Friday, too, were some of the bills that the governor vetoed. And because there was some bad legislation with regard to voting that he said no. And he, for instance, there was a bill that would allow election observers, people that come to watch how people vote and how election workers vote, come closer than 3 feet to a election worker and to a voter, which is intimidating and scary and, would violate privacy. And a number of other bills that the governor vetoed, including making it more difficult for people in nursing homes to be able to cast a vote without, having supervision from people who claim that they weren't capable of casting their own vote. So those were significant as well. And of course, Brian, the other thing is things that didn't come up, the legislature never considered. And the biggest oversight in that respect was a bill that would have allowed election clerks to begin counting absentee ballots the Monday before Election Day rather than waiting until Election Day to begin counting absentee ballots. The problem there, of course, is that absentee ballots are often not counted until well after the polls close, and then Republicans and conspiracy theorists and election deniers claimed, well, that just shows that absentee ballots are wrong and, you know, all of a sudden they're announced after midnight. Well, that's because clerks aren't allowed to begin counting and processing them until Election Day. So that's an example of sensible legislation that should have come to the legislature and would have been signed by the governor that never made it. But overall, yes, these last 2 years were certainly less contentious than 21 and 22. After the 2020 election.
Now, of course, the big issue hanging over the head of the legislature is the fact that we have new maps in effect for November. So we could be looking at a very different legislature after the elections in the fall. What does that look like? What do you think the new legislature will look like as a result of this?
Well, we'll be going from a situation where we had nearly what is called a supermajority of Republicans in both chambers of the legislature, two-thirds, to much more of what Wisconsin looks like, which is 50-50. We're truly the most purple state in the country. And with that closer division between Republicans and Democrats, I think you're going, the hope is that you're going to see more bipartisan cooperation, because Republicans will realize that with more competitive districts, they have to be more reasonable to a greater segment of the population. You know, when you're in a gerrymandered district, you never lose, so you don't have to really pay attention to people that you don't agree with. So the idea, or at least the hope, is that these new maps, which will be in effect for November, by the way, will result in closer division between Republicans and Democrats in the legislature, and more bipartisan cooperation, and then less voter attempts to suppress the vote, less attempts to go after Megan Wolf, who's the administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, who is constantly threatened by right-wing Republicans for no good reason other than they want someone to blame for Donald Trump not winning in 2020. I think a lot of that will be a little bit less with these new maps. That's the hope, anyway.
Now, the thing about the new maps, of course, is that they really don't do anything to change the system of redistricting. So we're going to have to go through this all over again in 2030 when the new census takes place. Are there any hopes for a true and actual nonpartisan redistricting process in the state, or did those hopes basically evaporate with the new maps?
Brian, hope on redistricting reform always springs eternal. And so, yes, there will be attempts by good government groups like ours and pro-reform legislators to get a different system in place, hopefully by 2031. And that could be either something that would more closely resemble the nonpartisan process they have in Iowa, although Iowa was, that bill was corrupted by Republicans and just recently and sort of changed around. So we've got work to do on that. Or the better thing would be to have a nonpartisan commission, which takes the legislature totally out of the redistricting process. But that would require a constitutional amendment, which is a very, very heavy lift. But nevertheless, we will be working towards that end. But the good news is that the maps that were signed into law in February, Governor Evers' maps, are a lot fairer and a lot better than the gerrymandered maps that we've had in place basically since 2011.
Well, with a new legislature, I mean, you know, this legislature has been spewing out constitutional amendments and like candy. So, you know, maybe with a more moderate legislature, maybe there'd actually be a chance of getting a decent constitutional amendment out in front of the people.
Well, that's right. And what's happened is when Republicans can't get something signed by the governor, they say, well, let's put it on a ballot that not too many people will really know what's involved. And as you know, there are two questions that would adversely affect voting on the April ballot, but then there's another one in November and then another one in April of 2025. And this making law by constitutional amendment is a terrible way to do things, because again, people do not necessarily understand or have really fully digested what these questions mean, and often will just vote yes because it seems reasonable. It's not a way to affect public policy in a positive way. So yes, hopefully that will be a more evenly divided legislature, less partisan, will result in the legislative process, the governor, and making laws the way it's supposed to be made, rather than trying to pull a fast one on a ballot question.
Okay, so we've talked about redistricting reform. We've talked about, you know, the ability of clerks to sort of count absentee ballots, you know, a little bit earlier to just make that system a little more efficient. What are some other things that Common Cause are looking to do, perhaps in the new legislative session, that would help further democracy in Wisconsin?
Well, there's so many things, but, you know, in the terms of the area of voting, there should be a ability for voters to return their absentee ballots in a more efficient manner to make sure that they'll be counted. It used to be in Wisconsin that if your absentee ballot arrived in the clerk's office within 3 days of an election afterwards, it would still be counted as long as it was postmarked. And that was restricted. We've restricted early voting in Wisconsin. It used to be 3 weeks. Now it's two. You can't even vote on the Sunday or Monday before an election. We should open that up. We used to have over 500 secure drop boxes in which people were able to be able to return their absentee ballots to make sure they got in on time. Those were all eliminated by the conservatives on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So there are things we can do to make voting more sensible. I would personally like to see the voter photo ID law, which is put in place in 2011, eliminated in Wisconsin. Our neighboring states of Minnesota and Illinois don't have that. There's no voter fraud. You don't need an ID in order to be able to vote. That should be something that should be relatively simple. So those are long-term democracy reforms that we're going to work for, at least in the voting area. And, you know, campaign finance reform, there's many, many things that we could do to just bring us back to where we were 30 years ago. I mean, we've really backtracked over the during the Walker administration and the last 25, 30 years.
We've seen some states experiment with instant runoff voting and various variations on that. Is that a possibility in Wisconsin?
You know, that is, and that is actually something that I think with a more closely divided legislature in terms of the partisanship, that you could see some bipartisan support for. There was even some Republican support for what we call final five or instant runoff voting that would, you know, give voters not only a first choice, but a second choice as well in elections. And that has come to a number of states, and that would be a good reform. You know, there's other things we should do, like making sure that whoever wins the popular vote also wins the presidency. This idea that we elect presidents with, you know, I mean, Hillary Clinton had, 3 million more votes than Trump in 2016. Biden had 7 or 8 million more than Trump. And yet it was such a close election because of the Electoral College. Those types of reforms would be worth looking at. And hopefully with a legislature that's less partisan, we could begin at least to move in that direction.
All right. We've been speaking with Jay Heck, Executive Director of Common Cause Wisconsin. Thanks so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock buzz.
Brian, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
And we'll be back with the Outdoor Adventure Report and the Song of the Week coming up right after this.
In the dark, it's raining in the park, but meantime, south of the river, you stop and you hold everything. A band is blowing Dixie, double fall time. You feel alright when you hear the music ring. Step inside, but you don't see too many faces. Coming in out of the rain and hear the jazz go down. Competition in other places, but the horns, they blowing that sound. Way on down south, way on down south, London town.
It's 8:25. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. It's time, as we do each and every week, for the Outdoor Adventure Report with Master Naturalist Paul Noldner. Take it away, Paul.
Thank you, Brother Brian and WORT, for covering all things natural. Your weekly Outdoor Adventure Report for the week of March 25 to 31 is brought to you by Madison Fun, Friends of Urban Nature, a partnership of your local parks, environmental, and Friends of Parks groups, helping connect our Madison area communities and kids with nature everywhere, all year round. Enjoy free fun, welcoming, diverse, fairly accessible, family and kid-friendly, naturalist-guided, educational bird and nature adventures every week along with many other great outings and events in Madison Parks and Natural Areas hosted by local nature groups. Outings are free with no registration unless noted. No special equipment is needed to enjoy the outdoors. No pets on the group outings, please. Just show up and join the fun. There is a new Nature Everywhere initiative that is getting a lot of press and public support, and we are happy that Madison is committed to being a leader in this. As an example, our Madison Fund, Friends of Urban Nature, Parks and Partner Groups have been helping connect diverse communities and kids with nearby urban nature in our neighborhoods across Madison with year-round weekly bird nature adventures for the past 10 years. As a leading Nature Everywhere city, Madison will be hosting an upcoming international Nature Everywhere conference in May. This creates a positive opportunity for us as citizens, groups, government agencies, and private businesses to put added priority on saving our remaining urban natural areas and opportunities to save and restore native trees and wildflowers for birds, bees, butterflies, and other wildlife, and for kids to enjoy right where they live. This can be done in every unmowed area and border in every Madison neighborhood, backyard, greenway, park, school, and business campus. Our collective acts of ethical land stewardship will help preserve and provide equal access to nearby nature and the well-documented of mental and physical health, child development, climate, and economic benefits of nearby nature for our diverse Madison neighborhoods, growing populations, and future generations of kids. This past week, Wild Ones presented indigenous wisdom, scientific knowledge, and the teaching of plants about how healing the land also helps heal ourselves. Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance offered an educational workshop to learn about saving our songbirds and how we can help right at home. Nature lovers, families, and kids enjoyed bird nature adventures to look for the first flowers of spring at Elder Leopold Nature Center, a spring equinox walk at Pheasant Branch Prairie, and looking for early bird migrants at the UW Lakeshore Preserve on a snowy Sunday, highlighted with hundreds of coots, buffaloheads, and common mergansers on the lake, and a beautiful bald eagle flyover. There was a big turnout for the BIPOC Birding Club Woodcock Walk on a beautiful evening at Cherokee Marsh. Coming up this week, there's lots more to enjoy outdoors. Beginning and experienced birders are invited to join popular bird guide Chuck Henriksen on Tuesday morning, March 26th, and every Tuesday morning, 7:15 a.m. at the Arboretum Visitors Center parking lot to look for the amazing variety of species they call the Arboretum home or pass through on migration. Email chenriksen, C-H-E-N-R-I-K-S-O-N, at gmail.com to get on the email list and receive his colorful and informative weekly reports and join him on walks. On Thursday, March 8th at 9 a.m., the UW Arboretum Winter Series will feature a presentation about frogs by Jessica Hua with U.S. Forest and Wildlife Ecology, looking at parasites, pollutants, and people. Does preserving biodiversity help protect amphibians from disease? This talk will consider how pollutants and land use, our land use influence biodiversity and our amphibian health, and how even things such as art and outreach and citizen science clarify our human contributions to disease dynamics and improve public engagement in citizen science, such as joining Friends of Amphibians. Look it up online and register to be involved in Friends of Amphibians at Arboretum, or for the talk, rather, at arboretum.wisc.edu. Students are invited to join UW Student Audubon on a birding field trip Saturday morning, March 30, and every Saturday morning. Email audubonsocietyuw@gmail.com to connect up. You can enjoy a Sunday afternoon walk with a free educational naturalist-guided arboretum nature walk on Sunday, March 24, 1 p.m. and every Sunday at the Visitor's Center. There are lots more great outdoor adventures coming up in April. Migration Magic Walk at Tenney Park, Be a Forager Steward at Cherokee Marsh, Nature Up Close, a senior adventure at Warner Park Center, Pasture to Prairie about preserving old and degraded urban areas at Owen Conservation Park, looking for ephemerals at Turville Point, helping with creek cleanup for Earth Week at Olbrich Canoe Launch, finding spring ephemerals at Warner Park, Do You Hear a Frog at Ella Leopold, Signs of Spring at Pheasant Branch Prairie, and a wildflower walk at the Lakeshore Preserve. And mark your calendars for Sunday, April 28th, noon to 4, for the 11th Annual Madison Fund Bird and Nature Festival at Warner Park. You can find details online at cityofmadison.com/parks and tinyurl.com, Madison Fun Adventures, and on Facebook and Nextdoor and other media with Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance, Four Lakes Sierra, BIPOC, Feminist Bird Club, Get Kids Outside, and many other Madison environmental community and friends groups. Join nature lovers, families, and friends on nearby outdoor adventures every week year-round. It's naturally fun.
In addition to the generous support of listener sponsors, the local businesses and organizations that underwrite WORT's programming play a vital role in the financial health of your community radio station. WORT is grateful for the support of our underwriters, and when you visit these businesses and organizations, please let them know that their support of WORT is appreciated. For information on how to become a WORT underwriter, contact me, Doug Holtz, at 608-256-2001 or visit our website at wortfm.org.
The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to Madison Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. This year's festival boasts over 140 films of all shapes and sizes, including the best cinema has to offer from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. We've got experimental, animated, and student films, as well as documentaries, restored classics, films for kids, and more. For the first time in years, we'll be returning to both the Bartell Theater and the Barrymore Theater. Plus, we've expanded on the UW campus into Music Hall, and we are heading east to Flick's Brewhouse at the Easttown Mall. The Wisconsin Film Festival curates, promotes, and exhibits programs that showcase the art of cinema. A complete festival guide is available in the March issue of Isthmus and online, and tickets are available at wifilmfest.org. The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to a screen near you, Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. Helping keep local arts alive for almost 50 years, this is WORT Madison.
This week, our song of the week is one my roommate insisted was the greatest ever.
You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. The Midwest Mujeres Collective seeks to expand entrepreneurship among Latina and Black women through mentorship and storytelling. The collective seeks to build skills among women of many cultures to ultimately close that persistent wage gap. Araceli Esparza is the founder and chief executive officer of Midwest Mujeres, and Araceli joins us now in the studio. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Hi, welcome everyone. Hello, hola, buenos dias.
So tell me a little bit about how Midwest Mujeres came about.
Somos un grupo. We're an online group. On Facebook, we have over 1,100 local, regional, national, possibly even international women, bisexual women, lesbians, and trans women, feminine forward women of color. From all kinds of different walks of life. We really cross, cross all kinds of divides. And we started about 6-8 years ago. Honestly, it was just for mental health reasons why we started this, this group. From there came this idea of, I want money. Yo quiero dinero. It's a song. It's an anthem. It's cheeky. Yeah. See, everyone laughs about it. Everyone smiles. And I think that's what I love about my movement, about this movement, not just only mine, right? Because it's been co-created through all of us, is that it's meant to make us laugh about something that sometimes gets us really down, right? So for many years as a community social worker here, through Nehemiah and Joining Forces for Families, I supported so many families through really rough times, rent eviction prevention, workplace harassment, racial discrimination, medical advocacy, etc. And a lot of that was financial. It's always financial. It's like the root cause of a lot of the work that we're doing out here. And from there, it inspired this conference, this one time. And I'm also a poet. I'm a little bit okay with the words. I like my words and I like utilizing words and helping women free their voice. And so that is what we do. We got the programs about 5 weeks. I was just out there recruiting somebody to apply. If you go our website, www.midwestmujeres.com, that's spelled MUJERES.com. If you go there, scroll a little bit, you'll see the call to action to apply. And it is a little bit competitive. And if you can't upload the video, I'm telling you now, just email it to me. The point here is get your name in the door, because there's been so many times where it almost feels like these opportunities, right, to express ourselves are only for allotted people, right? It's only for a certain people, like people that go to college or so forth. No, I am targeting everyday folks who are living extraordinary lives, because if it wasn't for their stories, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be enjoying this. I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't feel inspired. I wouldn't have been doing what I do. And so that's where it started. Was Midwest Mujeres. Was like during the pandemic, we started recording, vlogging, taking over Facebook in a major way because of the murder of George Floyd. And so we started doing these video calls with a bunch of other Latinos talking about the anti-blackness in our Latino community. And calling huge power from that. And it just kind of caught on for us. Ooh. And then I was like really into this whole, like, I'm a producer or something of that sort. And I'm a curator of stories. I know what's hot. You know, I know the sauce. I like the sauce. I have a knack to hearing good stories. And I want to like share those stories with other people.
So how does storytelling, I mean, how does the act of storytelling help people bridge this financial gap? What's the connection there?
Right. Okay, good question. Yes, absolutely. I think that a lot of times, I don't think, statistically it's been shown that women tend not to advocate for themselves for higher salaries. If we even apply for a job, if we don't know for sure 100% that we have all of those skill sets, we won't even apply for a higher paying job. So that's one reason, right? Just to gain the confidence to know that even if I don't have all the skills, I'll figure it out. Which was what a lot of men do. Another thing is, it's like, I think if you're confident in who you are and say you're facing workplace harassment and discrimination, of which most women of color do face that at one point or another, in one form or another, sometimes unbeknownst to them even, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes unbeknownst to them. So I think that once you're in those situations, freeing your voice and being able to articulate your story will help you advocate for yourself. One thing that I remember from my social work days was that there's just not enough of our Sallys to go around. There's just not enough of us social workers to go around. We can't be there at every moment. So how can I empower you, as Pastor Alex Yee would say, is to fish for another day, to have enough fish for the rest of the time, to learn for you to fish. And so this is the thing. This is how I'm teaching other people to fish for their own advocacy, for their own stories, for their own wages, to advocate for higher salaries for themselves, to go for a job that may seem unattainable because of their level of education or the requirements, but to know that they are that if they can articulate exactly what it is and that their lived experiences can be beneficial for this position, job, or what have you. I think that's what I'm trying to do.
So is your target audience people who work for an employer or for entrepreneurs or for both? And tell us a little bit about the organization itself. You started as a Facebook group and now you're a nonprofit and, mm-hmm. and doing events. What kinds of programs do you provide?
Right. Wow, that's a lot of questions.
Sorry.
So although I'm here by myself right now, please know that there's like tons of volunteers that I work with every day. So we're mainly volunteer run. And we have about six folks that are part of our main volunteer core board of advisory boards. So you were asking me like what programs we have. We have three programs, one in the fall, which is in the rural parts of Wisconsin. We partner with Dane County Libraries and we offer programming there. Why? There's a lot of Latinas in rural Dane County. Hey, Marshall. Hey, Sun Prairie. Hey, Wanakee. Hey, DeForest. Hey, Cambridge. I see you. We know you. I used to work in those areas myself, especially Marshall and Dodge County. So there's just so many Latino immigrantes trabajando in the fields over there. And so a lot of times they're not seeing, they're not taking advantage of public spaces like libraries. And so we make it into an innovative, creative space, and we do a Dia de los Muertos event there and Latina Wellness. So that's in our fall. In the winter, we do something on tech that's really hybrid, Canva. So Canva, public speaking, mentorship, and we partner with some of the women who have been graduates. So I really believe in that. It's like you graduate my program, now you get to teach it. And so some of the people who've gone through the program teach it, actually. And so they hybrid. We partner with women of color, Latinas in Milwaukee. Negozi, mercadera, hey, ladies. And then we go in the spring, which is where we are right now, April, May. It's a really recruitment for our big event in June. This year, I did something very different around this in January in Mexican culture. It's called like All Kings Day.
So, what is All Kings Day? What's it a celebration of?
Right. In Catholicism, you know, in the Bible, it was the three kings who went to go visit.
Okay.
Yes, yes. So,
Little Christmas, that's called in some cultures.
Yeah. So Three Kings Day, January. It's January 6th, I believe. And so we kind of turned it on its head. Called it Reinas en Roscas. Instead of Los Reyes, which is the kings, we called it the queens. And the roscas are these pastries. It's kind of like a crinkle.
Okay.
What you all consider a crinkle, like a Danish crinkle. It's very similar, but it's a king's cake. So my New Orleans people will know what that means. And if you find the baby, then that means that you have to make the next party. Okay,
that's
so
right.
You understand. So then we did this, a dream board. And I brought a couple of them to share with you. These micro stories. So beautiful. So beautiful. And I don't know the women, but I'm going to tell you, this one really, wow. This one really captivated me because I know this woman's story is like, this is what I used to dream of my own family. This is a first generation woman who was born in the United States probably. And
this is an anonymous story.
Oh, these are all anonymous. Yes, let's be honest.
Well, let's hear one of those.
Yes, let's hear of them. My dream this year is to open my coffee shop and export my parents' homegrown organic coffee from Mexico to Madison. Travel, visit new countries with familia, further my education, help others, buy a car, take my parents on vacation.
Oh, that's very sweet.
It is very sweet. This is what a lot of us, you know, I think dream of when we're, you know, when you're first generation, wanting to help your parents out because you see them struggling so hard. They're working crazy amounts of jobs and hours and just trying to provide for their families. And that's what Midwest Mujeres is about, intergenerational, going back to our roots and also feeding our future.
All right, we've been speaking with Midwest Mujeres founder and CEO Araceli Esparza. Thank you so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock bus.
Yeah, you're welcome. Come and visit us on June 15th, where we're going to take over the My Arts Theater. And yeah, find out more on our website. Thank you so much
for this
time.
Thank you so much. We'll be back with historic preservation activist Gary Tipler coming up right after this.
the storm. Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born. Into this world we're thrown. Like a dog without a bone, an actor out alone. Riders on the storm. There's a killer on the road. His brain is squirming like a toad. Take a long holiday. Let your children play. If you give this man a ride, sweet family will die. Killer.
Hey, it's 8:47. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. In January of 2024, the Madison Common Council voted to designate 2229 Eaton Ridge as the 183rd Madison landmark. This unassuming two-story colonial on Madison's near west side was the home of second wave feminist activist Catherine K. Clarenbach, who helped found and served as the first chair of the National Organization for Women. Historian and preservation activist Gary Tipler wrote the successful nomination for the home, and he joins us now in the studio. Gary, welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thank you, Brian.
So what was it about Catherine Clarenbach that impelled you to write this nomination to have this designated as a Madison landmark?
Well, a few years ago, I wrote about David Clarenbach's story and that of others of his contemporaries. And she was the person who was one of his mentors. And I had always been aware. I used to listen to her brief programs in the 70s, and it was remarkable to learn more about her. And it was a two-year process. So it was important, I thought, to have this designation not at all for the architecture or not necessarily for preserving the building. Rather, it was the importance of recognizing her as an honor of her works.
And who was Kay Clarenbach? For people who aren't familiar with her, what did she do?
She was born and raised outside of Sparta, Wisconsin, to a family who cared for education considerably, and she became rather outstanding in her studies. She went on to study at the University of Wisconsin and achieved advanced degrees and doctorates in both economics and in law. She went on to develop careers, plural, in several other states before moving back to Madison in 1960, where she almost immediately began teaching at Edgewood College in economics, and then took up volunteer opportunities to work under the auspices of the women's education at the UW Extension. Martha Peterson was the director. And that's where she began first her volunteer work. She proved to be exceptional in the depth of her interest, and at some point was given the part-time job, although she laughed when she said it. She's worked three-quarters time in order to devote a full-time job to raising her family, and worked three-quarters at home as well on these projects.
And so tell us a little bit about her involvement with the National Organization for Women. How did that come about?
Well, that has been written about many times, but from different points of view, it was rather remarkable. In her work, she developed, first in her volunteer work, she began evaluating and understanding the needs for women in the state, and identifying them via a year's study, after which she developed the platform for developing a Wisconsin or Governor's Commission on the Status of Women, which is something that was approved initially in Canada and then under Kennedy, President Kennedy. And she wanted to establish a Wisconsin commission. She went on to take that work nationally when other commissions were beginning to be formed a couple of years later, so that it was in 1966 at a national convention they realized, though it was hosted by the Department of Labor, she found that the Department of Labor was not particularly responsive to their concerns for the Equal Opportunities Commission's violations that they felt needed to be enforced. So at that event, 26 women agreed to establish a nonprofit organization that would be a lobbyist for women's rights and issues.
And so what does the landmark status for the for her home mean? What is that? What's the result of that?
I think initially what that means is that in this case, it's going to be educational, and that's the primary interest. It's going to be something that will be listed online. People can find it more readily rather than scouring through myriad publications on women's issues, histories, and therefore bringing it forward and connecting the dots to contemporary works and recent works in the area of women's issues.
And Clarenbach was also an author. She wrote The Marriage Partnership in 1979. What was significant about that?
Her family, she spoke to many kinds of groups, including many business groups across the state during her first few years. And she was frequently asked, because she was a conservative, she was conservatively dressed and coiffed and so on, why she didn't resemble the in-the-streets radical feminists of the time. And other people would say, well, if you only had a family, you'd understand our issues. And she said, I do have a family. She raised three children, Sarah, David, and Janet. And she did that in concert with her husband, and he often did the cooking. He developed a real estate company business quite near the family home on Regent Street so that he could be there when the children arrived home from school. They shared the tasks, and thus the partnership, of which she spoke frequently at almost every of the 40 or so speeches she gave each year.
So, I mean, ultimately, are there, for the Madison landmarks that have been designated, are there walking tours, or are there what other types of education is associated with that status?
This is within a historic district that is on the state and the National Register, the Westlawn Historic District, Westlawn Heights, and I don't recall whether there's been a walking tour there yet, but the Madison Trust for Historic Preservation does offer tours annually that are found on their website, madisonpreservation.org, and they offer them in various historic districts. The focus is largely on architecture, but also historical as to who developed and built these buildings, who lived in them.
So, I mean, here we are, two white men talking about the achievements of Kay Clarenbach. What did Clarenbach's work do to sort of popularize the idea of feminism and the idea that that women are people?
I would think that she spoke to common topics and issues that were bubbling up via grassroots and via new publications, magazine articles and books and so on. And she spoke to the issues that were at the heart of the problems. She spoke about the economic security of women and equal pay, many other rights. Recently, the 50th anniversary of the signing of federal legislation granting women the ability to get a credit card, for example, seems like a really minor thing today, but imagine them without. So she spoke to a popular movement that was growing. At some point, she stepped back and allowed the other women to become the leaders of the movement, but she still continued to do organizational work right into the 1980s.
Now, you mentioned that some of her conservative dress and perhaps coming from the Midwest, did that aid her in her organizing abilities?
I believe that it did. She was not the only one. There were others around the state, and she got to know them via her first year of work, so that once the Wisconsin Governor's Commission on the Status of Women would be established, that it would be populated by women who were already leaders in their communities. And I think it helped her in her speaking at all of these business groups, both in-state and nationally. And it, I think, turned heads for a lot of people who otherwise wouldn't have made time to understand, men in particular, who wouldn't have made time to understand these issues or to give time to them.
And perhaps someone that conservative men could relate to better than, say, Gloria Steinem or Betty Friedan, who...
I believe so, yes.
Less militant approach.
Well, perhaps. In fact, those women several times asked her to head and organize national organizations with them.
And so talk a little bit about Clarenbach's later life. When did she die, and what was she doing after sort of the heyday of now?
She died on March 4th, 1994, allegedly the only directive date. But she had lived there from, I think, August 1st, 1960. And she maintained herself quite a presence right up until just a couple of weeks before her death, where she entertained and educated and held a court with a lot of people from throughout, a lot of women throughout the U.S. who were leaders in the movement.
All right. We've been speaking with historic preservation activist Gary Tipler. Thank you so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock Buzz. And that wraps up our program for today. I'd like to thank our guests, Jay Heck, Executive Director of Common Cause Wisconsin, Araceli Esparza, founder of the Midwest Mujeres Collective, and historian and historic preservation activist Gary Tipler. Thanks to our engineer, Nate Carlin, who piloted the mighty WORT soundboard and spun all the great tunes today. Thanks to our receptionist, Marla Raboviak. This is WORT 89.9 FM Madison. We're also live streaming and podcasting at WORTFM.org. My name is Brian Standing. Global Revolutions is coming up next, right after the Insurgent Radio Kiosk.
You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, March 25th.
MedMen here for Action Weirdos Productions. This week in music history for March 25th. On March 24th, 1992, Arrested Development's debut album, 3 years, 5 months, and 2 days in the life of, was released. One way to get a greater perspective on history is to look at music, When indigenous Africans were stolen from their native lands, not only was their physical freedom taken away, their spiritual freedom was supplanted by Christianity. Their cultural music, drums in particular, was banned and replaced with gospel, which, although heavily influenced by ancestral African music, was all about praising the Christian God. The language of the soul is music. So, in effect, not only were the people physically enslaved, they lost touch with their souls as well. Three years, 5 months, and 2 days in the life of explored these ideas, and although several songs reference the Christian God, the track Fishing for Religion shows that they question Christianity.
When they want change, the preacher says shout it. The shout bring about change, I doubt it. All sound does is make you lose your voice.
The majority of the songs were in contrast to the gangster rap that was popular at the time, with songs about love, kindness, and reconnecting with the earth. The music is beat heavy with lots of melodic catchy tape loops and is very danceable. It's amazing to think that this album was released 22 years ago, but it does seem like we are moving in the direction of erasing or at least blurring the lines inside the Venn diagram of music, religion, and race. Also this week, March 25th, 1942, the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, is born. March 25th, 1957, Elvis Presley buys the Graceland Mansion for, any guesses? $102,500. That was this week, years ago. Let's learn from the past and do our future selves a favor by doing the right thing today.
Tonight at 6, the Madison Rafa Sister City Project and Jewish Voice for Peace will screen the film Israelism. Two young American Jews raised to unconditionally love Israel.